Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
The church's music from the 2nd century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The 6th century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to rightly see us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
How do you account for the near absence of Christian political parties in the United States? The United States has been largely a Christian-populated nation, influenced deeply by Christian sensibilities, never a Christian nation officially. But how do we understand the fact that in all of its history, there have been, except for the beginnings, very little Christian politics? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And if you have a nation that is founded on an anthropology that says man is basically good and just needs a little self-improvement, what kind of political results do you get, especially in the United States? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday, August the 11th, we're going to talk about Christian democracies. Dr. James Rogers joins us. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University and author of a forthcoming book titled States and Nation, Rightly Dividing Political Authority, and a recent column titled Lessons for America from Europe's Christian Democracy. Dr. Rogers, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks.
Can there be established religions without impinging on what is near and dear to many Americans' hearts, the free exercise of religion?
Absolutely. This is a fascinating area that's been developing, at least in fine, in the last 15 years or so, largely spurred by a series of opinions by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, starting with the 2004 Elk Grove Unified School District opinion, where he's both provided dissenting and concurring opinions, where he applies his form of originalism or textualism, goes back, looks at the First Amendment, and discusses what the purposes of the two clauses were. Now, really since the 1940s, when the U.S. Supreme Court began enforcing the First Amendment against the states in a more rigorous form, just sort of the assumption was that a religious establishment and free exercise were two sides of the same coin. Thomas and others have pointed out that they, in fact, serve almost entirely different purposes, and that you can guarantee free exercise, which would be incorporated against the states by the 14th Amendment, without concurrently limiting the authority of state governments to recognize or facilitate religions in particular ways. Now, how does this occur in the concrete? First of all, we need to sort of understand what religious establishments are. And there are different forms. I mean, most narrowly in the U.S. context, starting a couple hundred years ago, religious establishment was understood basically to be tax dollars going to support churches. And so if you hear somebody say that the last state to disestablish religion was Massachusetts in the 1930s, what they mean is Massachusetts was the last state to stop providing tax dollars to churches. At the same time, there's a lot of other definitions. There are confessional affirmations, and these can be generic or specific. I mean, even today, almost all U.S. state constitutions start their state Bill of Rights with some affirmation like the following. Now, I'm going to quote from the Missouri state constitution, since you're in St. Louis, but it's something like, you know, 45, 47, 42 other states have language almost very similar to this. So the preamble to the State of Missouri Bill of Rights starts, "We the people of Missouri, with profound reverence for the supreme ruler of the universe and grateful for his goodness, do establish this constitution for the better government of the state." Now, this is at least so far taken to be so generic as to not really run afoul of the Establishment Clause, although it's been litigated. Nonetheless, it does explicitly recognize a higher power over humanity from which rights proceed. The argument is that states have a reserve power, right? After all, the First Amendment specifically says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." And what Thomas has argued is this is a limitation on the power of the national government, both A, to establish a national religion, but B, and this comes from the specific language of the First Amendment, they wanted at the time the national government to be prohibited from interfering with state religious establishments. And so, right, the point is that you can have these confessional affirmations, which so many European countries do, and in fact, states did as well, without restricting what we call the freedom of conscience. Well, just one last example. The Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, in its Bill of Rights, does so in sort of superlative fashion. Article 2 provides a rousing protection for freedom of conscience, and for several lines goes on about how the government cannot impose on freedom of conscience. The very next article talks about not only the permissibility, but the obligation of the government to support religion, not only for spiritual purposes, but for civil reasons. And they obviously thought that there was no inconsistency between the fairly mild religious establishment that they created and the full recognition of freedom of conscience at the same time.
Why has the relationship between these two clauses been so profoundly misunderstood?
Yeah, that's a great question. From the same period of time, there have been arguments for disestablishment, famously James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, although Patrick Henry, right, the give me liberty or give me death, Patrick Henry was in favor of religious establishment in Virginia. And in a sense, because it wasn't sort of conflicted until the 1940s, sort of historians and commentators took the Jefferson-Madisonian line as really the only line. And it's really just been really with the rise of originalism or textualism where legal commentators and professors have gone back and looked more carefully both at what the meaning of the text is and what was going on at the time, because we need to remember when the First Amendment was ratified, right, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion, 12 out of the 13 states had religious establishments. And so there is no question that what was being prohibited there was national establishment in order to keep the national government's hands off what state governments could do.
Can you give us some examples of cases where governments have established religious institutions without harming free exercise?
Sure. And this is one of the points in the column on the European experience, because Europe provides us 100-year examples. As a matter of fact, so do American states. Let's just take two examples. One is tax dollars going to support churches. Now, we can argue about whether that's wise or not, but nonetheless, it's a form of establishment. Germany today basically has the Massachusetts system of religious establishment, where tax dollars go to churches or religious establishments of one's choice unless one chooses not to. One can basically opt out. I'm not sure where the tax dollars go then. maybe to a park or something like that. But nonetheless, right, most people in Germany go ahead and permit their tax dollars to be taken, sort of like the way that we give to presidential elections in the U.S., right? And it goes to support the churches over there. So that's an example of a tax system. I mean, it's a mild tax system because you can opt out of it. Like I said, it's more like the donations that we could provide to presidential elections if we so choose on our income tax forms. You know, an example of confessional system, I mean, we could look at, you know, any of probably, you know, Holland and so forth, but I think probably the best example known to Americans would be Great Britain, where they have a legally constitutionally recognized church, the Church of England, headed by the monarchy, and yet I don't think that anybody would go over to England and feel that they could not freely exercise whatever religious preference, at least within peaceful observance, that they would be restricted from free exercise. And so that's an example of a confessional church, although there's also tax money that goes to support those churches over there. But there's no question that it's the sine qua non of church establishment. At the same time, there's no question that free exercise is recognized in Germany, in England, in Holland, in Sweden, all of these places that have established religions.
Why do you think Americans are so leery of Christian political parties?
That's a complicated question. I mean, it's a great question. The first is that for whatever reason, the Jeffersonian, Madisonian line that certainly has credence is the message that began to predominate in the U.S. And the argument was, I mean, it came out from the European experience in the 1600s with religious wars that devastated the country. Now, the thing is that there have been several hundred more years of experience. And so when somebody comes up to me and says, you know, Jim, religious wars result from establishment, and as a result, we know that we don't want religion and politics to be intertwined in that way, and aside from the 100-year history of it doing peacefully over in Europe. One response is that there's been a lot more history. If you want to compare secularism and religion on the issue of bodies on the ground, we don't need to go much past the 20th century, in which two secular ideological movements, communism and fascism, killed tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people. And so if you want to put death in the balance, it is far from clear that religion comes on the short end of the stick. These secular movements killed many more people, millions of people. And so it appears that it's not related to, in any unique fashion, to religious involvement at all. And then secondly, the point that I just made, which was the point made in the column, is that we have, and again, Americans just don't follow European history or politics. We have 100 years experience where there have been Christian political parties with religious establishments where there's been no question that religious free exercise has been permitted, and there has been peaceful interaction between these religious parties and the other parties in the means by which they actually secured power and governed those countries.
So tell us, if you would, this is again a very complex question, but how did European Christian political parties become, in essence, Christless?
Well, that's an important question, not only for Europe, but for the U.S. as well, because there's a common opinion that we may be about 30 years behind where Europe is going. The issue or the question of how Europe became secularized, there are many hypotheses. I mean, one of which could be, this is, if you've followed Patrick Deneen's book on why liberalism failed, one could argue that the attempt by Christians to accommodate liberalism basically infected Christians and resulted in their secularization. I think that's too easy of an answer, though. And I don't believe Deneen's argument either with respect to the U.S. What happened is, as a result of the secularization, the Christian Democratic parties just followed society and became increasingly secularized as well. That said, even still, if you want to look at data dealing with church attendance or profession of faith, members of the Christian Democratic parties in Europe, even given how secularized so many of those countries are, have significantly higher professions of faith and church attendance and things like that than individuals who are not members of those parties.
We're discussing Christian democracies with Dr. James Rogers, political science professor at Texas A&M University. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues, Etc. After the break, we'll find out what he means when he says that liberal polities can flourish only in societies that embrace Christian absolutes. Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation. The entire cost is approximately $350,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org.
Or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th century.
Jesus has come and brings pleasure eternal.
The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We're talking about Christian democracies. Dr. James Rogers is our guest, author of a forthcoming book, States and Nation, Rightly Dividing Political Authority, and a recent column titled Lessons for America from Europe's Christian Democracy. Dr. Rogers, many have observed that liberal polities have been built on and continue to draw on Christian capital. You say that liberal polities can flourish only in societies that embrace Christian absolutes. What do you mean?
Well, the thing is that liberalism is unable to provide, believe me, I'm not the first person to say that, so I wouldn't even come close to saying that, to claiming that, is that liberalism is unable to provide its own foundations. You know, for example, a philosopher by the name of Richard Rorty, who passed away a few years ago, it was a famous what's called anti-foundationalist. And what that means is things like, he doesn't believe not only in things like Christian absolutes, but in any form of foundational absolute. Now, the thing is, the concession there is that he admitted that he could not provide a satisfying answer to the question, why not be cruel? And the thing is, he was thinking that in his context, people no longer need fundamental answers to those sorts of questions. The problem is that, right, I mean, he's a product of 1,000 years of Christendom, and even though he and others don't believe in the truth of Christianity, nonetheless, they reflect the habits of Christianity. The problem with his view is the assumption that the next generation will also answer the question, why not be cruel in the same way? And yet when we think about human nature and the depravity of human nature, it's not so difficult to think. I mean, we'll just think about a playground at a school, if you want to believe in original sin, where, I mean, there are certainly a lot of childhood innocence. At the same time, there's a lot of childhood cruelty because they haven't learned to restrain themselves. And this is the problem, is that without answers of this sort, the sort of society that liberalism requires, where people generally tell the truth, engage in fair trading, obey voluntarily the rule of law. You don't need the police with the big stick standing there in order to enforce laws. That there's a lot of, as it were, sort of self-regulation going on, because we want to image the character of our Father in Jesus in heaven through Jesus Christ, and as a result, right, believe in things like mercy and the like. And without those sorts of answers, without the ability to convert people who desire the desires of their Father in heaven, there's nothing to restrain society. There's nothing there that would invite people to restrict themselves. If it's all about autonomy, literally self-law, then, right, we're back to the garden, in which case we're all desiring to be God, and the only means of determining the outcome there among rival gods is to fight about it.
So in that vein, explain how it is that a belief in human depravity, to one degree or another, can guard against authoritarian government.
Well, there's a line in a lot of philosophical literature that, so Augustine was one of the first church fathers predominantly to focus on the notion of original sin. And one of the corollaries that a lot of non-believing philosophers argue is that Augustinianism implies authoritarian or totalitarian government. But it's exactly the opposite. First of all, there's a really famous passage from the Federalist 51. This is James Madison. But this is perhaps the most famous passage in Federalist 51, where Madison writes, "What is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself." Not sure that Madison was a full-fledged Augustinian, but it was in the air at the time, and this is a reflection of a Augustinian anthropology or an Augustinian picture of human nature. And what the recognition is that while sure all of us are afflicted by original sin and human depravity, the thing is that human magistrates also are. And as Madison recognizes, right, we need a government first that is both powerful enough to deal with the manifestations of human depravity in everyday life, robbery and murder and crimes of that sort. But just because one becomes a government official, it does not mean that one is immune from that. And as a result, we recognize that government officials may be tempted to abuse their power, and as a result, some restrictions consistent with allowing the government to do the work that it needs to do. And that's the big trick, right? But nonetheless, limitations on power of government officials is just as critical when we recognize human depravity. And the trick of finding that optimal point at which government and government power is strong enough to provide safety and security to the public, and yet not so powerful that government officials can abuse their power and prey upon the public, is really the central problem or the central puzzle in political theory.
You say that the very fact of human or humanity's spiritual slavery, it creates the conceptual ground for political freedom. How is that?
Well, again, it's a question, I'm sorry to use the 25-cent phrase, it's the issue of anthropology or human nature. And one of the central questions, I mean, anytime you read a political theorist, it was probably one of the best lessons I learned as a young political science student many years ago. A professor taught us to start by asking the philosopher who we're reading, what's the anthropology? Or what's the theory of human nature that we see there? Now, the thing is that there's, in modern ideologies, human nature is often taken to be changeable. Marxism is the most obvious example of that, which is freed from capitalist exploitation, human nature will change spontaneously, as it were, so that the need for civil government will wither away, right? Because the only thing that makes people nasty is capitalist exploitation. Well, it didn't quite work out that way, and so in order to change human nature, communist systems needed a huge superstructure in order to try to force people to change and behave in the way of the new man as understood by Marxism. And of course, famously, it didn't work. Augustinianism and the belief in human depravity recognizes that humans cannot change human nature. This is, again, another 25-cent phrase. This is called monergism, that only God can change the human. And so, for example, consider Paul's argument in 2 Timothy, in which case slavery to Satan entails not harshness, but gentleness and patience. So he writes, "The Lord's bondservant must with gentleness correct those who are in opposition. If perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth, and they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will." Right? Note that because the remedy for their slavery is beyond human hands, this is Augustine's divine monergism, that Paul commends human patience and gentleness because human nature can be changed only by God and not by humans. And what this implies is just a humility, a modesty for civil government. I mean, certainly we need to punish in order to deter, manifest the sins and things like that. But because the person cannot be converted via the sword, or through education, or through any human action, it counsels, like I said, some modesty with respect to the pretensions of civil government.
You say that Christian democracy's recognition that both freedom and solidarity are essential to human flourishing, that concept derives from Christianity's essentially sacramental core. What do you mean by that?
You have about 3 hours, maybe. I'll try to make this quick. My read is that the human predicament is what some call the social problem of the one and the many. If you've ever heard, I'm sure you've heard of Alexis de Tocqueville and Democracy America. This is one of the dualisms that he runs through there. And basically says there's a temptation in America. One side careens off into hyper-individualism and anarchy and anomie, lawlessness. The other, however, and he actually argues that in America, that collectivism is as or more of a threat than hyper-individualism, is to be absorbed into the mass, sort of a de-individualized collectivism. So this is the problem of the one and the many that we face since the fall in the garden. The only solution to the social problem of the one and the many is union with Jesus Christ through the gospel. And this is accomplished through This union is accomplished through the sacrament of baptism, in which we are truly and really joined with Christ in his body. And this is both has a vertical dimension, right? Our salvation because we are joined with Christ himself. But often we miss the horizontal dimension, which as a result of being united with Jesus Christ, we are united with one another as well. For example, in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul talks about our obligation to speak truth to one another for, quote, we are members one of another. So too in Romans 12, famously talking about the body, he says, so we who are many are one body in Christ and individually members one of another. Just as we are really, 25-cent phrase, ontologically united with Jesus Christ, so too his body, which encompasses not only right the cells in his physical body, but his church body as well, and that is a real union. We are united with one another. And so the center manifestation of the gospel as administered through the sacraments is this union where both our individuality is, I mean, not only affirmed, but is celebrated, as it were, but also this deep desire that we all have to be in solidarity with other humans is made as well. And this is, you know, if you look at Catholic social doctrine or the anti-revolutionary principles of the Calvinists in Holland, or look at the Lutheran influences on Christian democracy in Germany, that it's this picture that is established in and through the reality of baptism, what baptism does, and what is celebrated in the supper, that what we see is sort of the application of this reality in these other spheres of life, in particular in politics. And so, for example, in the Old Testament law, when God instructs Israel to be hospitable to the aliens and sojourners, he doesn't say, well, you know, they're not believers, but everything's relative, so, you know, be nice to them because they're different. No, instead he says, because you were aliens and sojourners in Egypt, therefore you need to be hospitable to the aliens and sojourners. It's basically an aspect of self-love, right? To love others as we love ourselves. That because we were aliens and sojourners before God, and God remedied that, so too, right, were to extend this to others. And again, the church is not the nation, and we need to be clear about that. But the only real aspect where this is solved is in the church, and then in the family, in the nation, in the city, we see images of this in sort of the partial unions that we see there.
Dr. James Rogers is our guest. We're talking about Christian democracies. The big question coming back, how do we account for the near absence of a Christian democratic movement in the U.S.?
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The third commandment teaches us to remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. We do this when we hold God's word sacred and gladly hear and learn it. Jesus invites the weak and heavy laden to rest in him, our true rest, because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. This weekend, rest in Jesus as you hear his word and receive his gifts. If you are in Southern Illinois, you're invited to join Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstatt to rest in the grace of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Learn more at trinitymillstatt.org.
Bahama Mama, Ocean Pacific, Paradise Island. Retreat from the heat with a shaved ice snow cone from Tropical Snow in Caseyville, Illinois. It's right across the street from Collinsville High School. Tropical Snow is open weekdays from 1 to 9 and weekends from noon to 9. Premium snow, epic flavors, lots of love. Tropical Snow, across the street from Collinsville High School at 2134 South Morrison Avenue in Caseyville.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Tuesday, August the 11th. We're talking about Christian democracies with Dr. James Rogers, Associate Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University. After we conclude our conversation with him, we will be remembering Old Testament patriarch Isaac. Dr. Kevin Golden will join us. Dr. Rogers, this is the big question. How do you account for the near absence of a Christian democratic movement in the U.S.?
Well, first and foremost, as I argued in the column, I could have talked about the Lord's Supper as well, there just wasn't enough space. The sacrament of baptism, the way that it is administered, the way that we understand it, isn't simply an act that we engage in. It constructs what we might call a normative universe. It implies an anthropology. All of the Christian democratic movement in Europe derives from communions that held to infant baptism, paedobaptism. Both the Roman Catholics, obviously, the Lutherans, obviously, and the Reformed were paedobaptists over in Europe, thinking of Holland and the like there, the Dutch. Now, the thing is, the baptistic culture of American evangelicalism implies a different anthropology. It is basically Lockean social contract theory writ in ecclesiastical terms, if I can use it that. And they have problems, and not just the Baptists, but the social contract folks have problems with what to do with infants. And it's a huge philosophical problem for the tradition. What infant baptism or paedobaptism implies for understanding society, however, is this. When we understand that infants aren't simply a tabula rasa, but actually are represented in a real fashion through their parents and through their leaders. And we can look in the scriptures for this. There are commitments made that they aren't simply blank slates. This creates a more organic, communitarian understanding of what human nature truly is or how it is fulfilled. And as a result, it's able to resolve this tension between the one and the many, between liberty on the one hand and solidarity on the other. And just as it is resolved in infant baptism or in the doctrine of the real presence in the supper, the fact that American evangelicalism, despite maybe honorary membership of the LCMS, maybe for many evangelicals or some of the Reform paedobaptistic communions, nonetheless, American evangelicalism in both sense and sensibility is overwhelmingly baptistic and as a result simply does not have the resources to understand this resolution of the problem of the one and the many. And without that, there is, as it were, sort of, it's difficult to make sense of sort of the way that Christian Democrats think about the nature of politics and government, because it's not simply a political theory. It comes out of the social doctrine of the church, out of the social implications, as it were, of the sacrament of baptism and the Lord's Supper.
So you're saying, in essence, that the asacramental nature of American evangelicalism actually robs it of the ability to think in the terms to resolve that tension between solidarity and freedom. How does that also play into American evangelicalism's relationship in particular with the Republican Party?
Right. This is the problem, right? Which is, if there's an individualistic theology that implies an individualistic social theory, we don't understand, first of all, the manifestation of solidarity that we could have. And as a result, you know, perhaps can sort of not only overemphasize individualistic tendencies in the United States, but then also look towards false gods to satisfy that need or desire for solidarity. And so, for example, today, some of my friends are arguing for a renewed form of nationalism, Now, first of all, I mean, nationalism in many forms is not at all inconsistent with Christianity. Far from it. At the same time, they are in essence arguing that nationalism is the primary font for solidarity in the United States rather than the church. And as a result of inverting that, not only are leading Americans astray and leading Christians astray, but basically providing a false hope, both for a sort of a false sense of solidarity, but also for potentially a dangerous form, because it's an idol. But 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it was the family, the natural family. And again, families are good biblical things. At the same time, Jesus expressly reforms the family around himself, right? Who are my mother and who are my brothers? And he reaches out to those in front of him. You, there, my disciples are my mother and my brothers and my sisters. There's a reason that people in the church call each other brothers and sisters, because that is the true family. Now, this is not to denigrate the fleshly family, the worldly family. At the same time, we need to understand that it's contingent. And whenever we put our hope in the worldly nation or the worldly family, rather, or the worldly city, rather than in those institutions as reflected in the church or through the church, then there's danger, it seems to me, and we're holding out a false hope.
Why is it important to note that all of the currents in European Christian democracy, whether they're Protestant or Catholic, derive from a baby baptizing theology?
Well, again, it's so critical because it implies a different view of human nature. It suggests true representation. And this is not secondary to Christian theology. All have fallen in Adam, and all who are saved in Jesus Christ, not as a result of our own work, but because of the work that Christ did. And as we are united with him, we receive the benefits of the works that he did. But this is not simply true in that sphere. As I mentioned, there are many examples in the scriptures where infants and other people are represented, where it talks about infants praising God. It talks about infants worshiping God, even bowing down, because that's what their godparents, as we could put it that way, were doing. And so the notion of sort of this organic communal unity just implies a different aspect of humanity than does sort of the hyper-liberal notion that we're just all individuals, and basically churches are religious clubs of sort of like-minded people.
We've spoken extensively here about essentially first principles when it comes to Christian democracy. With respect to specific issues, is there a possible future for Christian democracy in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, it's hard to get away from first principles. Let me say part of the answer is, as currently constituted, there is really no future for Christian democracy in the U.S. because of its Baptistic orientation. Now, my own observations are, and these are limited, and you know, I may be interpreting the evidence in a way that I want to rather than it actually suggests. But particularly among the younger Baptists that I run into these days, there is some consternation with the individualism, with the lack of community in Baptistic churches, with sort of the nationalism, sort of the pointing politically to remedies in power rather than in the spirit. And it seems to me that if believing Lutherans can get out of their silos and not be ashamed of their sacramental realism, if Roman Catholics can get in touch with Catholic social doctrine, and again, they have the vertical nature of the sacraments down, but if you've ever visited a Catholic church, oftentimes the horizontal dimension is lacking, and if Reformed Paedo-Baptists can get over their going round and round in circles over what paedobaptism means, given sort of their nominalistic approach to the sacrament. I think that there's the possibility that there's both a moment right now that these churches can speak to concerns that the broader believing public, which is overwhelmingly Baptistic in nature, Christians is willing to listen to. But that's, you know, as the Spirit moves, as I said, we by and large just don't share, Americans don't share the prerequisite understandings or practices in which European Christian democracy made sense, where this sort of resolution to the problem of the social one and the many, of liberty and solidarity, made sense in that context. And as currently constituted in American evangelicalism, just really doesn't make sense, or we're just unable to understand it in the American context.
Dr. James Rogers is Associate Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University. He's author of a forthcoming book, States and Nation, Rightly Dividing Political Authority, and a recent column titled Lessons for America from Europe's Christian Democracy. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Dr. Rogers, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be remembering Old Testament Patriarch Isaac along with the Church August 16th. Dr. Kevin Golden will be our guest next.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our study of St. Matthew with The Temptations of Christ. Jesus begins his ministry. Jesus calls the disciples. Jesus ministers to great crowds and Beatitudes, Part 1. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute, verse-by-verse, Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Did you know that for over 40 years, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries with low-cost loans and resources? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Because of faithful investors like you, we've been able to help church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations. To learn how you can get involved, call 800-843-8233.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Trinity Lutheran Church, LCMS, of Tryon, North Carolina, also serves the South Carolina upstate. We uphold the confessional standard of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. We follow the apostolic practice of celebrating the Lord's Supper each Lord's Day using a biblical historic liturgy. Our small parish is teeming with little ones, along with many of retirement age. Several Issues Etc. listeners have been welcomed into Christ's fold here from outside Lutheranism. We invite any unchurched in the area to join us at 10:15 each Sunday.